南無妙法蓮華経。南無妙法蓮華経。
Hello everyone, Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. Wonderful, wonderful to have you here and participate. So proud of your practice. Thank you for your participation in this Sangha. Yeah. If you hear congestion, if you sound funny, yeah. I used to say in different places I've lived that it was that time, allergy season, right? But I think Mississippi has 300 days a year of allergy season. I don't know. Whatever the case, my sinuses love to toy with my... Okay, we're going to continue. Handicapped as I may be as an effective communicator, turning off this computer's warnings of impending doom and disaster, as everything seems to be these days, with the Lankavatara Sutra, and we haven't gotten out of the introduction yet. So, but the introduction is fascinating, if for no other reason than it gives us quite an insight into the I won't say intentions, but certainly what colors the intentions of this translator's mission in translating his documents of the Lankavatara Sutra. That's not to dismiss them, but it's always helpful to know, you know, if you're looking through a lens, whether it's a camera, binoculars, or a telescope, it's helpful to know what the specific parameters of the lenses are that you're using, right? You wouldn't expect the images from your little 4-inch telescope, although there's, I know you astronomers and cosmologists out there using telescopes at home know that there's a vast difference in quality in lenses and telescopes and so on and so forth. But please, just follow along in generalities here. To look through a telescope at an observatory, an optical telescope at an observatory versus your store-bought, local store telescope, no reasonable person would expect to see the same thing. So all I'm saying is it's helpful to understand the lens we're looking through, right? And I say all this because there's a tendency, and this isn't just Buddhism, in any subject, to just pick up any book that has the key word on the subject that you might be investigating and assume that it is completely authoritative and the end-all, be-all, I read this and I will know. We need to be more critical of the information that we put on our heads. The information that ultimately is the lens that we are attempting to integrate into our own optical mind. And we need to understand that maybe some of the grounding of those lenses that stack up to provide us a view toward knowledge, maybe they're, you know, nearsighted or optically obtuse and not seeing the entire picture, as it were. Is that enough word salad? So anyway, without trying to define what I'm doing any further, this pen, this paper seems to soak up this color. I think we're about to read about skillful means. So this author is taking the time to go through these basic tenets, subjects, categories of Buddhist thinking in Mahayana, certainly, and elucidate their qualities, their parameters, their lenses. Yeah? So kind of useful as a general tool, but also clues us in on whether or not his description of skillful means matches up with the entirety of what we've learned, especially coming to this from the Lotus Sutra, right? See how on the mark he is and see where maybe he's pushing a fringe one way or another, which could be helpful in the addition of lenses we use to define our own experience. And at the same time, maybe, oh, I see, those lenses tend toward this kind of a fringe. So that would be helpful to know, right? So let's just get into it. Skillful means. The essential nature of love is to devise, to create, to accommodate itself to varying changing circumstances. And to this, the Buddha's love is no exception. So I've talked about this before. The word love is a very charismatic word used in poetry and novels and sappy novels to courageous and you know, from Romeo and Juliet, right, to love of country, nationalism, in all its forms, in earthly discussions, in our samsaric mind. Love is this huge umbrella term that, as we apply it, always is applied to relationships. And this is my version, okay? So love is one of these words where we try to encapsulate our human experience in its relation to environment. I mean, that's a big umbrella I'm putting around it. And so what I read this to say is that love in all of its forms, and this is important because Buddha love isn't a form, it's formless. So let's identify that mental hurdle first of all. So love, as we speak of it 99.9% of the time, is a samsaric definition of our attachments, our relations, our dualities with other, whether the other is the flag, the woman, the man, the relationship, the intimacy, the finishing of each other's sentences, the attachments. We're qualifying the nature of attachments. And how much or how little love there is some arbitrary measure of opinion, epistemology, so on and so forth. So it makes this word love very broad, but not just broad in its embrace, but broad in its multitudinous little degrees and variations of expression, right? So this is what he's identifying here. He's saying the essential nature of love is to devise, to create, to accommodate itself to varying changes in circumstances. In other words, for instance, in a relationship, your partner, your other, may have behaved in a way you didn't like. Now you have to modify your love? Do I accept that deviation? Do I feel so crushed by it that I actually lose some love? Or am I enamored by a different approach and that draws me closer with more love? You see how love in samsara is a negotiation, right? And this is what he's describing, to devise, to create, to accommodate. And then he says, to this, the Buddha's love is no exception. I'm not sure I like that statement. I mean, we can accept it and go on. But to think of enlightenments, because Buddha is not a person, to think of enlightenments, negotiation? That's just not right. Because Buddha love is unconditioned by its very definition. It has no condition. Its tendency is full acceptance, full engagement. There is no qualifier. That's enlightenment. No qualifiers, no tendencies and conditions. You might say, well, why do we call it love? Because it's hard for us to find a word that encapsulates the depth of engagement that pulls us with compassion to elevate everything around us to that love, to that state. So we use the word love, but not really a fitting word. Well, a word is a duality. Language is a duality. We fumble because what do we keep getting back to, folks? Whatever words you want to use, what do we use words for? Identification. Well, that's samsara. Boom. End of story. Remember, I keep telling you, Buddhism is about clarity, reason, and rational behavior. Behavior as a human, samsara, with a mind constantly aware that all of this is just the froth of bubbles in the ocean of life. Colorations, tendencies and conditions. So, first sentence into skillful means, I'm struggling with his definition of Buddha's love. But now let me go back to the title of this section, skillful means. Ah, so what he's actually trying to describe is that in our Bodhi position, as people coursing as bodhisattvas in the world, aware, as I was just saying, of Buddha-ness, it is our Bodhi that is carrying out this compassionate seesaw of devising, creating, and accommodating our behavior to inspire, to assist, to move others toward Bodhi, toward Buddha-ness. Ah. So here's that wishy-washy line, right? Buddha-ness being the Dharma, enlightened, unconditioned, itself cannot adopt a conditioned position in samsara in order to communicate. It is the universe, life itself. But to be aware of that, to be enlightened to that, requires this samsaric device, this Bodhi human sentient mind. The sentient mind is our vehicle of enlightenment. Duh. And with that sentient mind, that Bodhi, we can offer, share, again, inspire, I can't think of a better word, motivate others to see this enlightenment. Because there is no greater benefit to your life than to release yourself from the sufferings of all your attachments. How do we do that? Reach Bodhi, reach Buddha-ness, and course in this life with that awareness, and you too will lighten your load. This life will become amazing rather than a burden, because the burden is a choice. It's a choice altogether manifesting because of your karmic engine, but it doesn't have to be in your mind what the tendencies and conditions of the energy are. You can see well beyond that. And that's what we're trying to share and inspire, right? Moving on. He is ever devising for the enlightenment and emancipation of all sentient beings. He. Again, this is that slippery slope of language, yeah? It isn't he, the Buddha, who is wanting to emancipate all sentient beings. It is us, Bodhi, in a state of bodhisattva, who are wanting to spread without coloration this perceptive reality that will emancipate every individual for themselves from the constant avarice for possession, collecting, differentiation, identifying. Follow? This is technically known as the working of skillful means. So he finally gets to the point. In other words, maybe this is a correction of sorts because we're Lotus Sutra practitioners. But it is not Buddha that's walking around enlightening other people. It is Bodhisattva. It is the encompassing definition of Bodhisattva as a behavior of sentient mind emergent from this samsaric apparatus, bodies, that is spreading this knowledge, this wisdom, this experience. You can't put it in your hand. Here's some Buddha, have some. Right? But as a bodhisattva, I can inspire you, educate you, direct you to the Buddha in your hand, in your mind. This is the bodhisattva that does that. So this argument follows that Shakyamuni was Shakyamuni, a great sage, a bodhisattva of the Shakya clan. Shakyamuni. He wasn't Buddha. He was the first to enlighten to Buddha, Buddha-ness, and to teach others, but his teaching wasn't Buddha, it was Bodhisattva. Because Buddha doesn't have a voice, doesn't have a body, doesn't have a thing. It's a mind state, it's a perceptive state. That's why all of us already have it and can immediately invoke it. Because it doesn't belong elsewhere. It's happening now. Just thought of some analogies, but I'm going to try to stay with the text, okay? skillful means, he uses an Indian word here, upaya kausalya. Upaya of that word is the outcome of prajna and karuna, which he talked about earlier. Prajna being the perfection of wisdom or wisdom, and karuna being the heart, the emotive, the heart often used in, especially in Asian thinking, but also in Western thinking, although Westerners are more physically oriented to everything. Heart immediately becomes a muscle and a pump and all of those things. But heart in this usage is about intent, inclusion, right? The heart-mind connection even is talked about in martial arts or Qigong, the fact that we move energy through our bodies with a volition, a will toward, Tai Chi, right? Is the mind and heart, the mind and body. The heart stands in for behavior, beingness, but never without a mind. And the mind can't actuate its motives without the body. So mind, body, sentience, and heart, there's a unity there that we're always talking about in Buddhism. And it comes largely through this ancient philosophical connection of body-mind, yeah? When love worries itself over the destiny of the ignorant, wisdom, so to speak, weaves a net of skillful means whereby to catch them up from the depths of the ocean called birth, death, or samsara. By upaya, thus, the oneness of reality wherein the Buddha's enlightened mind abides transforms itself into the manifoldness of particular existences. Once again, all of those words really talking about bodhisattva. The enlightened Dharma, Buddha state of the engine of life, the universe, has to traverse or transcend, traverse maybe a better word, from that all-knowing being engine of formations into this vessel, this apparatus with a sentient mind aware of it, in order to communicate and share and inspire other sentient minds toward this knowledge, toward this knowing. Body-mind, mind-heart. So here we start, we're defining again the nature of compassion, love, right? And we read it in Gangyo all the time. And every day I think to myself, how can I bring all sentient minds to this awareness, to this awakening, right? It's that, we've talked about this before. It's in our recitation. And it's in the first person. It's a brilliant teaching tool of Shakyamuni's. So the Buddha's enlightened mind abides. Abides is bodhisattva. Transforms itself into the manifoldness of particular existences. So however it can express itself, this engine of life, this formation energy, finds a way to communicate it. To inculcate every form back into its knowledge of formlessness. Continue to be form, but understand what you are. And it's very freeing. That's Buddhism. There is a gem known as mani, which is perfectly transparent and colorless in itself. And just because of this characteristic, it reflects in it varieties of colors. Visitratrupa. Well, that's interesting. Interesting verbiage, because think about that. Mani, which is perfectly transparent and colorless in itself, well, how do you know it's there? If something is truly colorlessness, then it has no form. How do you define its being if there's no way to samsarically perceive it? And just because of this characteristic, it reflects in it varieties of colors. In other words, it's transparent, but somehow, like light. We think of light as white, but really, here's light. Do you see it? You only see it by virtue of what it's bouncing off of and what's collected and reflected. Mani. In the same way, the Buddha is conceived by beings. In the same way, his teachings is interpreted by them. That is, each one recognizes the Buddha and his teaching according to his disposition, understanding citta, right? Mental understanding, cognition, prejudice, propensity, and circumstance. It's how we see things. Again, the Buddha treats his fellow beings as an expert physician treats his patients suffering from various forms of illness. The ultimate aim is to cure them, but as ailments differ, medicines and treatments cannot be the same. For this reason, it is said that the Buddha speaks one language of enlightenment, which reverberates in the ears of his hearers in all possible sounds. Upaya may thus be considered, in a way, due to the infinite differentiation of individual characters rather than to the deliberate contrivance of transcendental wisdom on the part of the Buddha. Now, I know some of you are going, word salad, help! Yeah, that's a word salad. It's very well put, it's intellectual, but what does it mean? It means exactly what I've been saying, is that Buddha, the enlightenment, the full awareness of the life process, doesn't itself have arms, legs, head, eyeballs. It doesn't have characteristics. It is a knowing. And that knowing takes its characteristics from you and I. And you and I all have specific little tendencies and conditions that color the world, the experience of life. And so what he's saying is Buddha, the path to this full awareness and enlightenment, never changes. It doesn't say, I need to be a Bob Buddha or a Julie Buddha. That awareness works through our individual sentient minds with all of its colorations in order to intercommunicate with others, to ply our relationships with all of our characteristics and all of others' characteristics, to unearth all of these individually slightly differentiated minds toward this one clear awareness, Buddha-ness. And so the path to Buddha-ness takes innumerable forms, not only of one another, ourselves, whatever that is, but the interrelationships between one another, separate sentient minds. That's an unknowable, unfathomable, constant variation toward one thing. The thus come one, the Tathagata. You follow? So, from this perspective, think about the introduction to the Lotus Sutra, the Sutra of Innumerable Meaning. And I pointed this out in the Lotus Lectures. The Sutra of Innumerable Meanings, all three chapters of it, are about this transitional phase. Get ready, you're about to hear it. Lotus Sutra. And the Lotus Sutra closes with what? The virtues of pursuing it, right? Universal Bodhisattva, you and I. It's a very closed loop. Buddhism often called a circular system. This is why. It's a complete encapsulation of the experience of Buddha in this duality, in this samsaric space. So, now that, and that's the end of his definition for skillful means. This very act of bodhisattva is what leads to Buddha-ness, not only for ourselves, but to manufacture or to realize, sorry, full and perfect enlightenment, which are words we keep reading in different definitions of practice, must include, has to include, cannot exist without bodhisattva behavior, because that is what illuminates. Because it points out the areas of human experience that we ourselves as individual sentient minds are lacking in order to conceive of the largesse of Buddha-ness, not just an egocentric Buddha-ness. Next chapter, One Buddha with Many Names. That chapter heading excites me because this is something that I've repeated often about words like emanations of Buddha. What does that mean? Like they're radiating light. No, it's about bodhisattva imagination reinterpreting that Buddha-ness in the various innumerable ways to bring other sentient minds into understanding. Building wisdom, prajna. So let's see what he has to say about this. This is the Mahayana again, right? All the Buddhas are of one essence. They are the same as far as their inner enlightenment, their dharmakaya, and their being furnished with the 32 major and the 8 minor marks of excellence are concerned. So these are all the characteristics that are imposed on these different Buddhas throughout the skillful means. It's no accident that he talked about skillful means before he talks about this. Because like Amitabha and
my head is feeling swollen with the mucus.
But all of the various Buddhas throughout all of the sutras are inventions of Buddha-ness, albeit by bodhisattvas, right? Once again, remember, Buddha is a knowing state, not a human state. It's a state of mind. But they're given characteristics so we can identify the different mental constructs of us, our differences. They're not different Buddhas. Buddha's Buddha. But in skillful means, we give pathways to Buddha, specific personages, characteristics, something to aim at, something to latch onto, because we are latching beings, aren't we? So skillful means is a bridge from our constant behavior of possessing, identifying, and having to a no longer needing to do that. But we need that first instantiation of desire in order to reach for our Buddha-ness. So this is skillful means, right? So this is the Buddha with many names. It's a device. But when they wish to train beings according to their characteristics, these various versions of Buddha, they assume varieties of forms appearing differently to different beings, and thus there are many titles and appellations of the Buddha as to be beyond calculation. So even though you might call it Buddha of, what was the one we did recently on the aromas, the smells, the fully adorned Buddha, whatever name Buddha you want to give, as you study toward perceiving that Buddha, it shifts. It's constantly shifting because it shifts in the expression of your wisdom until you finally drop the whole pretense of different Buddhas and understand Buddha's Buddha. But that will be your awakening, your enlightenment. By the time you get there, you'll have no use for these personages. You will see them for what they are, tools. One noteworthy fact about this: the Buddha's assuming so many names is that he is not only known in various personal names, but also given a number of abstract titles such as no birth, emptiness, suchness, reality, nirvana, eternity, sameness, trueness, cessation, etc. Because all of those words are pointing to an aspect of being that is mani. It has no characteristics. It has no colors. It has no appearance. It's an awakening, a paradigm, right? The Buddha is thus personal as well as metaphysical. All right. All that means is that our expression, our experience of Buddha-ness comes through our specific miasm and myriad karmic engines, our release from instantiation and attachment to instantiation comes via the particular vessel and set of karma that we experience as human individuals, right? So each one of us has our Buddha wisdom, our Buddha path, but what we attain is the suchness of Buddha. It's no longer qualified by characteristics or tendencies and conditions. It is the one. Many in body, one in mind, Itai Doshin. So on studying and working toward, things may be differentiated, but the more we experience and learn what enlightenment is, as we experience it, all of those definitions fall away. But as bodhisattva, we carry them and the experience of others with us in our expansive understanding of what Buddha is. Make sense? The Lanka, which is the subject of this sutra, Dalanka here does not forget to add that though the Buddha is known by so many different names, he, or it, is thereby neither fattened or nor emaciated, as he is like the moon in water, neither immersed nor emerging. This simile is generally regarded as best describing the relation of unity and multiplicity, of one absolute reality, and this world of names and forms. Well, I need to spend a little bit of time on that, but hopefully, if you've been with this channel for any amount of time, I can't put a time component to it, but you should be aware that this statement, like the moon and water, neither immersed nor emerging, this simile, generally regarded as the best describing the relation of unity and multiplicity. When you see the moon reflected in a body of clear water, you know that the moon you see in the water, though it may capture your attention, is not the moon itself. And so this is this analogy can be used in many, many ways. Simile. It's an analogy in that as a bodhisattva, as a person who's trained their mind constantly to see the full picture, to understand the full implications of life in every single moment, we can appreciate the glory of the moon, the beautiful moon, even though we also know we are looking at the reflection of it on a lake. In fact, it may be that the magnification on the lake, which is so much closer physically to us, feels more intimate than to look up in the sky at that moon so many thousands of miles away. The idea here is that as bodhisattvas, we can see the moon in everyone and ourselves. We're all like lakes reflecting the moon, or Buddha-ness. And some of us may not be as clear as others, but it's there. The moon itself, we know, is there. Any way it can be reflected in a lake full of reeds or ripples or whatever, we see it reflected in the minds of those all around us, of the universe. We see the great life engine of the universe in its galaxies and planets and stars and asteroids. Same thing. It's the same formula. And so, you know, we can adopt, I'm Sylvain Buddha and you're John Buddha and you're, on and on and on. But what are we actually saying? We're saying that we can see and experience Buddha-ness in all of our minds. It's just that our particular lenses that we're honing are particular to us. And getting to Buddha is Buddha wisdom. It's our path. It's our, destroying our obstacles, our attachments that obfuscate Buddha from us, right? You want to get to Buddha? You need to clear your attachments. You need to convert those attachments into lenses, abilities to see beyond, understand their construction only to understand how to get around them. You don't obliterate them. I like this camera. I like this equipment. I like talking to you. And now we're circling back around to love. Because the only value for this camera and this computer and this dialogue and these words is to communicate Buddha-ness to you and you to communicate Buddha-ness back to me. We unify in our pursuit of Buddha-ness. All right. That's all I've got to blah, blah, blah about today. That's far enough. We'll continue with the next one, maybe this afternoon, but probably tomorrow. At any rate, it will be up on this channel. It will be up on Patreon. It will also be transferred into an audio podcast, which you can get at the Buddhahood Podcast. Yeah. Wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget, lots of free information on threefoldlotus.com. Many books. I haven't written one in a long time, but there are some collections of data as well as my own writings available on Lulu. What am I forgetting? Oh, yeah. Make sure you have a mandala. Namo Myo Renge Kyo. Thank you. Thank you for subscribing. That really helps this channel. For liking these videos. If you don't, let me know. Write a comment. Let me know what I missed, what I tripped up over. Give me an opportunity to correct myself. Or just to help with words, your words, so I can know how you're constructing your ideas. Maybe you're right. Maybe you're more right than I am. Or maybe you seized on some words and they're misleading you. That's what the Sangha is for. Let's communicate. Let's chew this apart until we all understand clearly our objective. Yeah. Deeply, deeply appreciate you for doing that. You know, and I've received a lot of emails just direct to me, not in the comments. Because we're not always that open to want to declare our question so that everyone can read it or see it, right? So I understand that. Keep it private. Just send it to me directly, tlksylvain@gmail.com, yeah? What's important is that we all maintain our practice, that we deepen our confidence. That deepens our conviction. That deepens our experience. Namo Myo Renge Kyo. All right. I'll let you go. Thank you. And I'll see you in the next one, okay? Bye for now.